where the service is provided from.
The Winnipeg Fiber Festival highlights tariff struggles and pushes to rebuild Canada's wool industry.
You know, at least 30% of my business goes to the United States, and I have some very loyal customers down there. I just couldn't make sense of shipping to them.
Administration in the States is not one that we can trust.
The First People's Gathering House opens at SFU in Burnaby.
Everything is designed to highlight the local culture, from the interior design, but also the landscape.
And a Canadian glass artist flies to Tanzania to help local artisans forge new markets.
This one is very unlike the other stuff I've done. This is about arts and crafts, so this tacks onto a whole other part of my life. I've never been to Tanzania. I've never been to East Africa. This is all new, which is going to be really cool. But this is the jumping off spot for people going to the Serengeti, to Kilimanjaro, to the crater.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Hello, welcome again. Nice to have you with us. My name is Boris Chassaigne. I'll be with you for the next half hour. Liverpool stained glass artist Scott Slesser is in Arusha, Tanzania, working with the city's artisans to capitalize on the tourist trade and to help them develop new ways to get their products to more people. Scott Slesser is a retired Canadian diplomat and owner of Sats Glass, a stained glass studio in Liverpool, Nova Scotia. As a Canadian foreign affairs officer and consul general, he led the strategic planning and training in places like India, Afghanistan, and Thailand. Since he retired, he's done a couple of stints in places like Mongolia and Cambodia with Catalyst Plus. That's a Canadian NGO focused on economic development in indigenous communities and emerging countries. This will be his first trip with Catalyst Plus, working with artists in another country. He'll be leading sessions, helping about 20 artisans in Arusha capitalized on the tourist and hiker market near Mount Kilimanjaro. Here's Rick Conrad speaking with Scott Slesser in Tanzania.
This one is very unlike the other stuff I've done. This is about arts and crafts. So this tacks onto a whole other part of my life. I've never been to Tanzania. I've never been to East Africa. This is all new, which is going to be really cool. But this is the jumping off spot for people going to the Serengeti, to Kilimanjaro, to the crater. And so they wanted to, in this institute, look into, as part of their tourism program, working with craftspeople, with artisans, and sort of up their game a bit.
He'll be working with artists in Arusha, a city of more than 600,000. Near Mount Kilimanjaro and the Serengeti. In an interview before he left for Tanzania, Slesser said he'll be helping local artists develop ways to get their goods into the hands of tourists and hikers.
But we'll be talking about the market there. Who are they actually trying to sell to? Because I don't think they've necessarily done a full assessment, you know. So, and I have. The government of Tanzania has done some. So we have some starting points of the ages of people coming there, where they're coming from, a lot from the U.S., Canada, Europe. You got to understand some of these folks. And these are people who are going to climb Kilimanjaro. These are guys who are getting a carry-on, you know, and with their hiking boots on. So how do you put something in their pocket? So we're going to generate a whole whack of ideas. That's part of what we'll do. And then they'll have to decide how they're going to implement that.
Slesser has been doing glass art for more than 25 years. And he has lived in Queens County with his wife, also a retired diplomat, since 2022. He's one of the organizers of the Queens Coast Art Tour Studio Rally. He says he hopes to be able to connect some artists from his trip in Tanzania with Queens County artisans who have offered to be occasional mentors.
You know, it'd be fun if there were a couple folks from here, even just an hour a month for 3 or 4 months, hook up with somebody in Tanzania just to talk about, what are you making today? You know, that looks terrible, you know, or that's so beautiful, or, you know, have you thought of, you know, changing that line that way, whatever. So that's my hope, that there'll be a little bit of that. We'll see how it plays out.
Slesser says he hopes his 2 weeks with the artisans in Arusha can help set them up for success.
If a couple of these people develop habits that help them, you know, design more appropriate stuff for the folks that are coming in, then I think that's a real win too. So we're gonna, like I said, I'm going to spend a bit of time with them on, you know, who are these Westerners that are coming here with their money, and then how do you sort of represent your culture, your the local techniques and all of that in a way that, you know, satisfies you as an artisan, but also allows you to make a few bucks.
Slessor says meeting new people and experiencing different cultures are part of why he enjoys taking on these projects.
So for me, it's it's a lot of fun. I mean, I'm going to get to meet 20 people, but then I get to see a new part of the world, which is really fun. You know, I think that's a fair amount of a win for me.
I'm Rick Conrad.
Hi, I'm Kareem Mosna in Kingston, Ontario. You are tuned to Viewpoints.
Over 100 protesters met outside Metro Place Saint-Henri in Montreal on Saturday, September 13, to call for Quebec to scrap its proposed changes to the rent capping formula. The Quebec government of the Coalition Avenir Québec says they introduced the changes to simplify the process around calculating rent increases. The new formula would take into account fewer variables. Tenants say the heavier weighting of the Consumer Price Index, CPI, gives landlords more power to follow the market rate of units rather than recoup the day-to-day cost of building management. Protesters say a petition against the changes will be soon deposited at the National Assembly. They hope the new housing minister will listen. Details with Jules Bugiel.
Nous sommes des locataires.
C'est vrai.
Tenez des bons logements.
C'est vrai.
Nous voulons des logements.
C'est vrai.
Mais des logements sociaux.
C'est vrai.
Over 100 protesters met outside Metro Place Saint-Henri on Saturday. Demonstrators like Rosalie Bélanger-Rioux say the changes to Quebec's formula for fixing the rent would favor landlords over tenants.
Le gouvernement de la CAQ veut faire un projet de loi pour changer le calcul des hausses des loyers. Puis ce projet de loi-là est à l'avantage des propriétaires et des riches, pas à l'avantage des locataires.
The old formula to fix the rent took into account 13 variables. The new one, only 4. It's a move that then Housing Minister Francilaine Duronceau said would simplify the process of calculating a rent increase. But there's a catch. The new formula places more weight on the Consumer Price Index for the reference year and the 3 preceding it. Tenants' rights groups say the changes would create a vicious cycle of rising rents by tying rent increases to the market value of properties rather than the core costs of managing them. Plus, landlords will now have 20 years to recoup costs of major renovations at a fixed rate of 5% annually. These changes were introduced in a bill last April. Despite outcry from renters, they were upheld in this month's latest draft of the legislation. Noémie Beauvais says there's only so much more time that tenants can act. There's a petition against the changes, signed by more than 12,000 people. It's going to be deposited at the National Assembly soon. We hope that the new Minister of Housing, Sonia Bélanger, will listen. Beauvais works with the RECLAC, the umbrella organization for tenants' rights groups in Quebec. They were the ones who put on Saturday's protest, organizing at least 4 more across the province over a 2-day period. They want the province to freeze the rents entirely, not simplify the process to hike them. What we want is for the whole bill to be withdrawn. I'm Jules Bugel with files from Victoria Greco.
Hi, this is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You are tuned to Viewpoints.
Many farmers and small business owners are finding it increasingly difficult to turn a profit. At Winnipeg's 14th annual Fiber Festival, wool farmers say they are feeling the pinch of imposed U.S. tariffs. Leah Bauer of Apotekandi says increasing costs are something she hasn't been able to stop thinking about. For Bauer, government support is key to making local production viable. Bauer isn't the only one experiencing fears of rising costs. Ash Alberg, a media and marketing coordinator and board of directors of the Manitoba Fiber Festival, says both farmers and small business owners are angry and unsure of what their futures hold. Here's Ryan Funk in Winnipeg, Manitoba.
With tariffs from the United States, many Manitoba farmers and small business owners say turning a profit is harder than ever. That concern was front and center at the 14th annual Fiber Festival in Winnipeg. Leah Bauer, owner of Apothecandy.
This has been basically consuming, all of my waking hours and some of my sleeping hours over the last little while, and especially the last few weeks as all of these changes have been coming into place with the de minimis.
She began as a goat farmer, later combining herbal medicine and natural dyeing to create goat milk soap and botanical skincare. But with 30% of her products once shipped to the U.S., Bauer says new tariff rules forced a difficult choice.
You know, at least 30% of my business goes to the United States, and I have some very loyal customers down there. And so it really was hard to tell them that I just couldn't make sense of shipping to them, and I didn't want them to end up with additional tariffs or fees and unhappy, or ending up having shipments refused and sent back. It just made the most sense for me to turn off shipments. And that'll be interesting to see how it affects the rest of my year, because I'm going into my busy season right now, right?
Bauer isn't alone. Festival organizer and board chair Ash Ahlberg said many vendors share Leah's concerns.
Administration in the States is not one that we can trust. And there's so much upheaval and like lack of clarity around things and lack of being able to trust that something will be stable long enough for you to make plans and follow them through makes it really difficult as a small business owner to figure out, like, you know, what are you going to do for the holiday season?
Beyond tariffs, the festival highlighted challenges facing Canada's wool industry. About 90% of the country's wool is exported for processing, while most of what Canadians use is imported. Anna Hunter is a farmer and small business owner.
And the reason is we've lost our infrastructure. We don't have the manufacturing facilities, the labor, or the knowledge on how to deal with our domestic wool industry. So, I think there's a lot of efforts that are being made to bring back wool production in Canada and in Manitoba. We now have two wool mills. We have thriving events like this that are creating that connection, that are trying to connect to the local sources of wool.
For organizers like Ash Ahlberg, the festival is also about reminding people where their clothing comes from.
Clothing is also agricultural. You know, we've been so separated from it that people can forget that. But clothing is at its core an agricultural product as well. So all of those things that we think about when we think about local food movements and sustainability of food also apply to textiles.
As for Bauer, she believes government support is key in helping small businesses thrive.
What I would like to see for me as a small business is a lot more support for small businesses in understanding the CUSMA regulations in terms of proving Canadian made. I raise my own goats, I milk them, I grow my own plants, right? This is Canadian made. But figuring out and having that information available for a small business like me, it's a little bit harder to come by.
Despite ongoing challenges and financial struggles in farmers and small business owners, the Fiber Festival ended on a hopeful note.
I hope that everybody just takes away a lot of joy. I think that is something that right now can feel really fleeting for a lot of folks and really hard to find. But I hope that this just is a weekend that inspires people, that lights them up, that makes them excited about things. And, you know, maybe they learn a new skill. Maybe they learn something that they didn't understand before. Maybe they make a new friend. Maybe they completely change their life. That has happened on more than one occasion. But I hope, if nothing else, people leave with a smile on their face.
I'm Ryan Funk.
Questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.
You're on the air with Viewpoints.
Might soon land at an airport to take a peek out the window towards the control tower and see no traffic controllers. At least not looking out of the windows. Yes, you heard right. NAF Canada and the city of Kingston have broken ground on the country's first ever digital air traffic facility in Kingston. So instead of relying on controllers looking directly out of a tower, the new facility will use high-definition cameras and high-speed networks to create a simulated out-of-the-window view. Digital facilities like this are an emerging aviation trend across the globe. Some 65 digital facilities are either operating or in development in 16 countries. While this facility is temporary, Kingston will eventually host Canada's first permanent digital hub, managing up to 20 airports by early 2030. Christina Laurie in Kingston, Ontario.
NAV Canada has broken ground on the country's first ever digital air traffic facility right here in Kingston. This temporary site will serve as the foundation for next-generation air navigation technologies before a permanent digital hub is established in the city. David Shepherd, NAV Canada's Vice President and Chief Technology Officer, explained in an interview how Kingston's new facility will transform the current air traffic control model.
Yeah, it's very different in terms of the nature around how the services are going to be provided forward. Today, we have staff that work actually physically at a location in a physical building looking at windows. Tomorrow, with this technology, the introduction of this technology, we'll be bringing in state-of-the-art cameras, equipment that will and high-speed networks that will bring in a video feed and simulate the out-the-window view onto a screen that can be independent of the location of where the service is provided from. And the technology that's available actually also includes significant improvements from what's available from out the human eye. So things like digital overlays, or you can see surveillance, automatic detection, tracking, that all improves the safety environment for our employees and for the aviation community.
So why Kingston? Shepherd says a combination of factors made the city an ideal fit.
We ended up looking across the country to determine where we thought would make most sense to start trialing this technology and our first digital hub as well. And we ended up narrowing in within a region of a number of different cities. And Kingston was looked at for a number of different factors. On three categories, work, live, and play. And it really was looking at it from an employee's perspective around the quality of life, not just at the work environment, but for their family and for themselves in terms of the city that they're living in. And so Kingston came out amongst the top within the region that we were looking for. In addition, it's got proximity to Ottawa, which is an important element, particularly for this first site, for our technical teams to go there and our operational teams to go there to trial the technology, but also the regulator, which is Transport Canada, to be part of the process as well and be able to hop in a car and go down to Kingston and see the technology as it's evolving to ensure that they're confident in the solution and the capabilities as well.
The Kingston site is part of NAV Canada's broader Digital Aerodrome Air Traffic Services Initiative, joining a global shift already underway in 16 other countries.
Yeah, so we end up looking across the globe, really, to see, you know, who is doing what in air traffic control services using these digital facilities. And there's a number of really interesting models that are out there. One is in London City, where they end up remoting in a very busy airport into Swanwick, so it's the southern part of the UK. And the other one was in Norway, where there was a digital hub concept that we end up seeing, which was where we think the future is, where it's not just about moving single airports, it's looking at this much more holistically as an organization around how we can move multiple airports into a single location so that we can provide more staffing flexibility, we can concentrate sort of the technology investments in the future as well. And so looking at those models, we ended up mirroring ours off of the Norway model.
The permanent hub in Kingston is expected to be up and running in the early 2030s and will eventually host remote services for up to 20 airports.
Yeah, it's all dependent on how the technology evolves and getting through a number of stages of approvals for ourselves to make sure we're confident that the safety case behind it, the technology is functioning, and our operational staff are able to use it appropriately, and making sure our regulator with Transport Canada is also confident in the capabilities that we've demonstrated along the way. So there's a number of gates that we're moving along, but the more permanent solution is we're looking in the early 2030s. For us working towards that. But there is, we're starting with Kingston at the Kingston Airport. And then we will be moving, we'll be adding one additional airport to trial out the remote capabilities within the next few years associated with that. And then after that, that's where we start building up the digital hub and scaling that up.
For now, Kingston will lead the way in testing Canada's aviation future. I'm Christina Laurie, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative. Beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints.
And we close our show out west, where the First Peoples Gathering House opened its doors to the public on September 12. First announced 5 years ago, the First Peoples Gathering House, located at the Simon Fraser University Burnaby campus, is a ceremonial longhouse that will serve to celebrate Indigenous knowledge and culture at SFU. Before the opening ceremony, Danny Nesvadarani was able to get a look inside the First Peoples Gathering House. He also took that opportunity to speak with Eldon Yellowhorn, an SFU professor with the Department of Indigenous Studies, and Lyle Sparrow, a carver from the Musqueam Nation. First, here's Eldon Yellowhorn.
Prior to this, the Indigenous community didn't really have much of a footprint here on campus. And this building really stands in stark contrast to that brutalist style of architecture that was, you know, very part of Arthur Erickson's design. And this creates kind of an architectural dialogue between the very organic ideas of this space and the concrete and edged corners of the rest of the university. The way we designed the place with the architect, you know, taking the traditional or the vernacular architecture of local First Nations and using that as the template for creating the physical structure so that even somebody walking past here, it takes like 2 minutes to walk past here, but they'll learn something about First Nations people in that time. So we designed it. Everything is designed to highlight the local culture from the interior design, but also the landscape. We used native plants to do the landscaping and kind of really emphasizing local area, the local area and what it means. Like the place, Lukwaitin, the place of our Arbutus trees. And so we're looking, even if you look at the outside of the building, it's designed to look like our Arbutus trees, the bark of Arbutus trees, you know, and as the building ages, it'll take on that resemblance more.
In the Great Hall of the First Peoples Gathering House, there are four house posts that have been carved by a member of each of the four host nations. Before the opening, we had the opportunity to speak with Lyle Sparrow, a carver from the Musqueam Nation, who shared with us the personal meaning of the house post that he carved and what it depicts.
When the Kamloops thing came out, given our past history on the boarding schools, I just wanted to honor the ones that were left and never found. So that's the meaning behind the pole is Mother Earth on the bottom, giving, passing the young ones up to grandfather and freeing them. I don't know, there's just a lot of bad history about it, and my parents went through it, and it wasn't until later years that I found out, you know, what had happened to them, and, you know, sort of had me in a mode of thinking of, you know, like the other people across this country that went through the, you know, similar things, and know, it's just to honor them and, you know, give some healing to the ones that are still here and free the ones that are not. And, you know, thanks to Kamloops, it's worldwide. You know, it's not something that you can dismiss anymore and say, no, it never happened. It happened. And, you know, like I said, I'm kind of proud of my parents, too, where they never really brought it up about what really happened to them in the boarding schools. But when I learned what did happen, it sort of hurts the heart.
Lyle Sparrow then went on to explain his personal experience carving this house post and some of what it brought up for him.
I mean, there were some days where it was hard, you know, because my mind is, you know, with the pole, what I was doing. And then, but at the same time, thinking back on, you know, different things that came to light as I was growing up. You know, so like I said, there were hard days and there were good days.
Later in the day, the public opening ceremony began, which included opening words from local Indigenous elders from the Squamish and Musqueam Nations, as well as various song and dance performances, including from the Red Tail Spirit Singers.
Thanks to Danny Nesbadarani.
Do you have questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.
That's it for this episode of Viewpoints. Thanks to the LGI team and to our journalists today, Rick Conrad, Jules Bugel, Danny Nesbadarani, Christina Laurie, and Ryan Funk. Our national editors are Victoria Fenner and Conrad Fox. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassin. It was a pleasure to have you with us this week. And until the next, ciao.
Listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia. Ooh,
Open Mic on CJSF 90.1 is where you can listen to fresh new releases from any genre, any day of the week. Visit cjsf.ca for the latest open mic schedule.
You're listening to